From the bizarre world of the paranormal to the sinister secrets of the U.S. government, the Black Vault has become known worldwide as the premier spot for anything and everything conspiracy. Now, join me, John Greenwald Jr., as we dive into the research together in hopes to decipher these mysteries. This is the Black Vault Radio. Welcome, everybody, to the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr. Thanks so much for making the Black Vault Radio your podcast of choice. You know how many radio shows there are out there to download and stream. It's ridiculous. So thank you for joining me here on BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network. Today's guest, Mr. Carl Feint, is a world-renowned expert on underwater UFOs. Now, some of you may know Carl personally. Some of you may know of his work. Others may hear underwater UFOs and start scratching their heads and say, wait a minute, there's no UFOs that are seen underwater. Au contraire, Carl has spent many years researching the phenomenon, has done an amazing job at cataloging from books, newspaper articles, witnesses, you name it. He's collecting those reports. He's made a database of over 1,090 cases of these underwater UFOs. Now, I'm fascinated by this side of the topic, mainly because I really don't know much about it. So I've invited Carl on to tell not only me, but you guys a little bit about the phenomena itself. What are being seen under the water? Is it like what's being photographed above our heads, seen streaking across the skies, caught on videotape, caught on digital cameras, now cell phone cameras, and it's just getting ridiculous. But what's going on underneath the water? Carl will be here in just a couple minutes to talk about it. Now, that leads me to a brand new video, one of many, actually, that's been added to the Black Vault video archive in just the last couple of days. And for those of you who have been following these, what are being called drone UFOs, you know, some of you may have already dismissed it as a hoax. I think I was, you know, fairly confident to say that it was all a hoax, although very well thought out hoax. I think the analysis done on the images by many researchers, probably from across the globe, but I know of a few in the States here, it didn't look obvious, like an obvious true story to me. It looked like an obvious hoax. Then those documents surfaced, and then some more photographs, then the high-resolution photographs of these drone UFOs. Now, if you're completely wondering what the heck I am talking about, check out the Black Vault Encyclopedia Project. If you go to www.theblackvault.com, you're going to see a button right there that says Encyclopedia. Now, I've talked about this last week on the Black Vault Radio. I'm excited about this particular section because it's just growing at a huge rate, the UFO case file database. There's UFO case files being added every couple of days, videos, high-resolution photos, high-resolution videos even, that I've been able to archive for witnesses also across the globe, all the way from France, many parts of the U.S. People are sending me their videos. I'm archiving them. Hey, if you've got one and want to stream it online, I'll do that for you. Just drop me an email. Anyway, go into the UFO case file database, and one of the case files under D for drone UFOs, go figure, drone UFOs, click on that, and you'll see everything. It's a full encyclopedia reference to everything related, at least everything that I know of, to these drone UFOs. Now, why am I talking to you about this? Well, a new headline from Kentucky just started circulating the internet yesterday about one of these drone UFOs caught on video. Now, I kind of laughed it off as being, oh boy, here we go again. But then I found it a little bit interesting because when you download the video, it's a news piece from a local news station over there, and it is one of these supposed drone UFOs in front of the moon. And a guy was videotaping the moon, and all of a sudden one of these things popped down into his line of camera sight and caught it on camera. Now, I don't know if this is the same guy who's circulating the rumor, or if maybe, although a lot of the pictures look doctored, maybe there's some truth to this story. Check it out. Drone UFOs. Now, after the break, take you underwater with underwater UFOs and Mr. Carl Feint. Stay tuned. welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald Jr., and joining me on the air, Mr. Carl Feint, researcher of underwater UFOs. Carl, thank you so much for joining me here on the Black Vault Radio.
My pleasure, sir.
It's good to have you on the air because I've been wanting to get you on the show for a little while now because I met you last year at the International MUFON Symposium and gave a wonderful talk on underwater UFOs. Saw you again this year, and I knew we just had to get together on the air, talk a little bit about your research. So, Carl, let me pass the torch to you. Tell me a little bit about yourself, and tell me what is it exactly that you do.
Well, technically, I'm retired. what I do is a lot of work on my website, which is Water UFOs, and a lot of research into it. And I've come to several conclusions, as you know, from that one MUFON presentation I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a lot of hours in on this stuff, both collecting and you know, trying to put things in perspective. And my education was 2 years of aeronautical engineering. Didn't finish, but after that, I had a good understanding of aviation, and I was in the Air Force. And airlines, aviation's been my life since I was, I guess, 6 years old or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of strange. I'm doing this nautical thing when I was Air Force all my life, you know, or airplanes.
So, yeah, kind of a little bit of a switch there. Now, just so everybody understands, your website is www.waterufo.net. Waterufo.net. Now, am I accurate to say that these UFOs, which people primarily see, or at least they primarily videotape them or photograph them in the sky, same types of craft are being seen underwater?
It's the exact same craft. I had the horror of being on a history show that featured a UFO with a fishtail on it. Needless to say, what's in the sky goes into the water. It's the same craft. It's kind of like a submarine coming out and trying to fly. You know, it's a UFO. No matter which medium it's in, space or air or water, it's the same craft.
Now, them being sighted in the water, is that a common thing?
Yes, I've got 1,093 cases so far, and of course I keep adding as I get them. Digging them is probably the hardest part of the whole thing, because when ufology first started off, you didn't want to talk about aliens being in the craft because they made such drastic turns, and you figured they'd be smashed against the wall of the UFO.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody talked about aliens, you kind of put them at arm's length and said, well, you got a crazy person here. And the same goes for a water UFO, because you try to picture an airplane going headlong into the water, and needless to say, it's not going to have any wings anymore. They're going to be ripped off, and, you know, it's like hitting cement.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days, you had maybe one case per book or per article or something about water UFOs. So my main, compulsion, I guess, was to find every case I could where a UFO did go into the water or came out of the water or hovered above the water. And basically, that's what my site represents. Now, as I went along, I started finding various things that were pertinent. I mean, there were different things, like going into, coming out of water was kind of simplistic, but abductees and water, aircraft carriers and what happened to major large ships and so forth, beams of light into water. I can go right down the list, and each one of these broke off separately as I started studying, you know, water UFOs.
Mm-hmm. Now, on your site, it says you've got 1,093 cases.
Correct,
From the year 1067.
Correct.
That's amazing. I mean, what exactly, let's kind of go back in time and start a little bit on the older cases. What exactly was going on?
Okay, well, excuse me a second. If you go to the list of sightings page, I have them broken down into various groups, but there's one called the master list. If you click on the master list, you will get the entire list of sightings, all 1,093. You just keep scrolling and scrolling. The thing is, in the old days, we didn't realize, about these historical UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming more to the fore now. There's a guy named Chris Albeck who runs a website called Mongonia, and what that is, he compiles all old UFO cases, not water cases necessarily, but all old, pre-47 and back in history.
Mm-hmm.
And he does an excellent job on it. So anyway, I've gotten several from him, and I've found a few of my own and given him some of my stuff. And basically, it's kind of, you know, back then they didn't know UFOs. There was no such technical thing. And so as time went on, you're getting these various stories about strange things that came out of the sea, and it was reported by some ship's captain, and it's put in some particular kind of a mariner's log of some sort. And they've kind of floated through the age. Well, nobody pays a whole lot of attention. It's like the sea serpents and Loch Ness Monster and all that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they were real. I mean, they match what we consider a water UFO today. I have a page on my website called Sea Serpents and Water UFOs. I have three sea serpents, which you can... I actually went and put blue text in it to show that I was talking, not the author of the article, the newspaper article.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very long newspaper article about a fishing trip. And it was a kind of a really weird fishing trip for these guys. They encountered a lot of different things. But it wasn't recognized back then. All they could figure it came out of the sea, and it was some kind of a monster. They referred to the thing having eight eyes. Eight eyes. And this happened in the state of Washington, by the way.
And what year was this case?
I'm sorry?
What year did this happen?
I think it was 1923 or something like that.
Wow, so it's going a little bit back there.
Indian Ocean. This was 1893.
Let's see. Well, first and foremost...
I got it. Puget Sound. Here we go. The official date is July
2nd,
1893. 1893. Published... I'm sorry?
I was just going to say, for those that are listening online, if you go to www.waterufo.net, first I want to point out, over 1,000 of these underwater UFO sightings have been cataloged by our guest, Carl Feind. Click on the list of sightings, make sure I have that right at the top once you enter the site, and that gives you the database. What Carl's referencing now about the sea serpents and water UFOs, that's a little bit farther down the page, and that gives you the three cases that Carl's talking about. One, mm-hmm. which you referenced now, from 1893. I mean, that's amazing that this is much more common than I thought. I didn't realize that there were so many cases out there to be collected of these underwater UFOs. Now, when you say sea serpents, Are you thinking that maybe in 1893 that was their interpretation at the time, because there weren't any other real reports that they could compare this to, or aircraft, I should say, to compare this to and say, oh, it looked like this or that? Is that just their interpretation, or do you believe that there is some sort of...
Well, the case comes from the Tacoma Daily Ledger, Tacoma, mm-hmm. Washington, right?
Okay.
And the title on it is An Electric Monster.
Interesting.
Now, I mean, if we saw a headline like that today, you know, we'd kind of scoff at it. But
right.
When you go through the text, and it's quite a bit of text there, as a matter of fact, and like I said, I inserted my blue text in there just so that you could distinguish between my interpretations and comparisons to UFOs as opposed to the newspaper's article, which is in black text.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite a long piece. And what involves is electrocution of two people, not to die. They were knocked out. And the monster had eight gleaming eyes. Well, I don't know of any sea creature that has eight gleaming eyes. And is, I forget this, I think it was 150 feet long.
Wow.
So needless to say, this was not your normal electric, sea serpent. And I believe what they were looking at was eight windows on mm-hmm. the craft.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, here it is. The monster fish, or whatever you may call it, was fully 150 feet long. So you have it right there. It's just a misinterpretation from old folk tales. Now, this is prior to the Wright brothers, you know,
mm-hmm.
so you didn't even have airplanes back then. And here this thing is going in and out of water, electrifying people and terrorizing. And, you say to yourself, no, this can't possibly be some kind of junk, but they detailed this thing. They went to the witnesses, and they had each of the witnesses confirm this thing. And so, yes, there was something strange back then.
Well, let me jump ahead a little bit in time, because you've collected and seen so many of these reports. Let's get to the invention of sonar. I mean, are these things also being picked up on sonar? Do you have cases like that?
Oh, yeah. Let me see if I can get back here. Yes. I have sonar and radar combined because radar is strictly a surface thing. You don't use radar underwater, and sonar is, of course, just underwater. But there are a few cases in there. I don't know offhand which ones, but the craft passed from radar above water into water and was picked up by sonar. So here you have two different sets of instruments picking up one craft. And so it's very important because, scientists keep telling us it's no good unless we have some kind of instrumentation to pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here you have two different instruments, radar and sonar, and they're picking up the same craft.
And they're picking them up, which is the amazing thing. Now, is science kind of approaching this topic right now? Do you know of any institutions or organizations out there that are pursuing these underwater UFO sightings?
No institutions per se. As a matter of fact, I'm called the default expert because I'm the only one doing it. And I haven't written a book, so therefore I'm not an author. I'm in the process of writing a book. But in any event, organizations, no. There's no separate organization for it, nor would I want one to be separate because it's a UFO.
Mm-hmm.
And MUFON can handle it just as well as anybody else as far as cases go, you know.
Now,
as a matter of fact, I did two water cases, and they are in MUFON. So one was in a dam down in Maryland, and another one was a friend of the family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they're still happening, but there isn't necessarily a separate organization. That paper I gave at MUFON kind of encompassed what I found out about it, and like I said, the way it operates in the air, it operates underwater exactly the same way.
That's fascinating. Now let me ask you this. Are there cases where there have been... I ask this with hesitation only because how easy is it to take photographs or video underwater, let alone if you see something out of the blue, so to speak? How can you take a picture of that? But are there cases where there's been photographs or video?
There's two that I know of. Well, there's one that's very famous, but that's above water. It had nothing to do with the water per se. And that's Trinidad. This is not Trinidad Island. This is an island in the Atlantic Ocean opposite South America, Rio de Janeiro, I believe. Very tiny thing in the middle of the ocean, and this happened during the geophysical year. But as far as photographs with the UFO doing something with water, I have one from a Turkish researcher that was taken by a diver who was photographing underwater, and all of a sudden he's got this thing in front of him. But I can't verify that photo. The other photo is from Bruce McAbee, who I'm sure you're very familiar with.
Yes, absolutely. Who analyzes many UFO photographs. You can visit him on the Internet. Just search Google for Dr. Bruce McAbee. But I'm sorry, Carl, I'm the music means we've got to take a break. So I didn't mean to cut you off there, but we're going to be right back with Carl Feint on the topic of underwater UFOs. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Fuck.
Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I'm talking to Carl Feint on the topic of underwater UFOs. Now, Carl, before the break, sorry I had to get you cut off there. Those breaks kind of come out of nowhere. The time's flying by here on Black Vault Radio. But thank you for joining me, number one. And number two, you were telling us about a case of Dr. Bruce McAbee, world-renowned expert on analyzing UFO photographs and just being an all-around UFO expert, had to contribute to this niche in the field. Let me go ahead and continue. Have you continue that.
Okay, the other photograph was taken down in Gulf Breeze, Florida, and that was done by a guy named Ed Walters, and Bruce got involved in it because him and Ed Walters wrote a book together called UFOs Are Real and Here's the Proof.
Mm-hmm.
And in that particular book is the photograph. Let me get back to that. In any event, what this UFO is doing is it was way across the bay. With a background of trees and houses and as a backdrop. And there's water going from the surface to the bottom of the UFO. And that was what was so important to me because that represented a suction below the craft, which I had discovered in many other water cases. Usually it's referred to sucking up water.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is sucking up water, but it's not sucking up water for a purpose. It's not trying to take water on board. It's just a vacuum below the UFO.
Okay.
But the whole thing actually is covered in on my website on a thing called Physical Influences on Water. And what that is the paper that I won second prize for. But if you keep scrolling down on this thing, you'll eventually see how this field is structured and what it does to the water in each of the cases. Excuse me. As you move down again, and each one of them, you can see what the field is doing and
mm-hmm.
how it's affecting the water in all of the various forms. And the suction is the very last one. It's in Figure 4. And they all come from my picture that I drew one night in 2005, February 2005. I was just frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
You got to tell me when I'm over my time.
No. Keep going. Please keep going.
Okay. Very good. In any event, I just like I said, I was frustrated. I had these four different groups, and I'm just saying they're not related in any way, shape, or form. So what I did is I got my drafting board out, and I started drawing the cases from the lowest one to the highest one. And when I finished it, I couldn't sleep the rest of the night. I was awake all night long. And I finally said, well, there's no sense. I'm not sleeping. I might as well start writing the report on it, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so simple, so simplistic. Anybody will recognize what's going on right away. As soon as you see the way the field's rotating in the drawings, you can see why it's affecting the water the way it is.
Now, so I have this connection correct. Is this from the case or the photo from Bruce McAbee? Is that the connection?
Well, the connection is on the last drawing in this thing
mm-hmm.
on that page I was talking about. Is you see the water being sucked up to the UFO.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's because there's a vacuum below the UFO. In many cases, off getting off water, you have cases where cars are kind of lifted off the road and the occupant says, I was turning the steering wheel, I was hitting the brakes, and I just kept going in the same direction the UFO was going. Well, that's the reason is the car is actually being sucked up off the roadway. That's the amount of suction. You're picking up a car. Well, if you can pick up a car, you can pick up molecular water as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happening. The suction below the UFO is actually sucking the water up towards it, not intentionally. It's just a function of the field.
Do you think that this is a different type of propulsion, or are you saying that the physics work exactly the same, whether in air or in water, the way these things are operating?
Exactly. It works air, water, space, it doesn't matter. The field is rotating. Actually, the field is not a means of propulsion. The field is a protection device. If you're out in space and you're traveling at, 9,000 miles or better, as they've been clocked at, and you've got a meteor traveling at 125,000 miles an hour, and it comes up towards you, you're going to get socked good. Well, the whole purpose of this rotating field is to divert whatever's touching the field away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does that beautifully because as soon as the rock hits the field, it's not only moving the UFO, it might probably move the UFO a little bit, but it's actually the field is moving the rock, you know, to the rear and out of its way. So the rock never penetrates into the craft.
Wow.
Which is one of our problems with the space station, of course. That thing takes hits all the time.
Right, right. Carl, you've done an amazing job. www.waterufo.net. Scroll down to the bottom. You'll see Carl's work, research, and the diagrams. If you haven't seen them already, you can surf while you're listening. If you're listening via theblackvault.com, just open up a new browser, take a look at Carl's site. Enjoy the music coming your way right here on the Black Vault Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to BVRN, the Black Vault Radio Network. Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I am your host, John Greenwald, Jr., and I'm joined by Carl Feint on the topic of underwater UFOs. Carl, thanks so much for joining me, talking about your research into this very bizarre phenomenon, going back to 1067, do I have that date correctly? 1067,
correct.
one of your oldest cases, all the way up to, I'm guessing, probably in 2007. It looks like your website, yeah, July 2nd, 2007. I have to ask, after you've talked a little bit about a few of these cases, what exactly do you think they are?
What do I think the UFOs are?
What do you think that these underwater UFOs, again, unidentified flying objects, I know that, but do you have an opinion? Have you based some kind of theory on your research?
Well, I mean, if you're talking why do they go into the water, in this particular solar system of ours, we're the only planet with liquid water.
Mm-hmm.
Liquid water. Sometimes they play almost like children, you know, diving into, coming out, diving back in, coming out. It's kind of like a fun thing to do, I guess, you know. It's a matter of, you know, how many planets in a galaxy do have liquid water, you know. So if we're on a road map, it could possibly be that we're one of the places to, find it. As a matter of fact, I was just going to say, I've got a paper coming out in October, my paper. It's the JAR, Journal of Abduction Research.
Mm-hmm.
And abductees go underwater. I have in that paper this coming October, I have an article in there about three particular people who have been underwater and seen the field being held off, seen the water being held off by the field. And they've gone to underwater bases. I don't know if you know of Ivan T. Sanderson's book. It was called Invisible Residents.
I am familiar with it.
Yeah, and in his book, he's trying to make like there's a civilization living under the sea, which was kind of like the basis of the movie. What was it called?
I think I know which one you're talking about because I can picture the scene in the movie.
The Abyss. The Abyss.
Mm-hmm.
In that thing at the very end of the movie, this whole huge saucer thing comes up out of the water and has ships sitting on top of it, from the Navy. And it's kind of like there's a huge civilization under the sea. I don't believe in that. I believe that there may be some kind of bases, you know, like maintenance facilities or, you know, accommodations for a rest period or something like that underwater. But I don't believe there's a civilization below the water.
But it is safe to say that you believe that these are extraterrestrial in nature.
I believe, yes.
I see.
We don't have any technology to compare with it. The closest you could say to bases underwater is that, I forget the guy's name, he wrote two books on underground bases and underwater bases, Sauer or something like that. And he says we have the capacity to build bases underwater. Of course, he's thinking tunneling from land out to water, not from water in. But these craft, evidently the aliens have, or extraterrestrials have, done the work themselves, and they are able to enter this base underwater. I mean, it's like you're opening a door, and that'd be totally impossible for us to do. So, yes, I do believe they do it.
Now, I'm looking at your website at a couple other topics of interest, as you call them, and one of which that caught my eye was missing ships. Now, I have not even loaded the page. I haven't even clicked on it yet, but it caught my eye. Can you tell me a little bit about
it? You're not going to find very much on the page except for my disdain for it. Sanderson's book, he has the Bermuda Triangle type thing, and he says, oh, this ship went missing and that ship went missing. And I had this thing about missing ships with another guy, and I said, before satellites, these tales were written up in books, nautical books, about gigantic waves that plummeted the ship and sank it and whatever. And I have another cases about meteors falling next to ships and causing large swells and so forth. The superwave was discovered by satellite to actually be. Now, this is the scientists coming along and say, yes, there are superwaves. Well, this is something that pops up on a ship without warning, practically. And so a lot of these missing ships, I would say 100% of the missing ships are either due to meteors going through the ship or these super waves that are plummeting ships down into the depths. I can't picture a UFO physically trying to pick up a ship.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's bizarre. I mean, that's something the size of a rowboat, you know.
Right. Do you think they...
Go ahead.
No, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
No, that's basically, that page is just my thing about my disdain for the... So many people say, oh, yeah, they're responsible for everything, and they're not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have limits just like we have limits. They have physics just like we have physics. So it's totally incomprehensible to me to say that some UFO is going to pick up a battleship and, you know, skirt it away somewhere. It's way beyond the realm.
Now, one of the other topics of interest that's catching my eye, and I just kind of wanted to bring some of these onto the show because I think it's fascinating, fish reactions to a UFO.
Oh, now, fish reactions?
Yeah. Let me ask you about that. What is that all about?
Well, I'm it's kind of, as you'll see, Miss Joan Woodward helped me with this in a way. She did some of the text.
Mm-hmm.
I only have four cases of fish reactions. Now, if you're in a rowboat and one of these things pops out next to your rowboat, you're not looking at the water, you're not looking at the fish, you're just terrified by this gigantic thing that's just popped out next to you somewhere. So a lot of times these details are missed. And remind me about Chris Stiles later and all that. About that. In any event, on these particular four cases, that's all I have, is four cases of animal of fish reaction.
Mm-hmm.
They are frightened and trying to run for the shore or run away, you know, from the craft. So they definitely do have a fear. Can't say what kind of a fear because we don't know what they're perceiving. And it's almost like animal reactions. Now, Joan Woodward had written a paper on animal reactions, and she was trying to compare what possibly could set off an animal, because usually dogs, cats, cattle, they all stampede when one of these things shows up. So I had put that in because there is definitely an animal reaction. Now, I also have a related one. You picked fish reactions, but above that is dead in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, dead in the water is very significant because I have much more. I have about nine cases of that. And this is mainly fish showing up dead. And I have ducks and geese in one case on a pond, and then I have two professional divers that were found dead in relation to a UFO incident.
Now, is there an obvious reason why they're dead? I mean, are they just floating in the water?
Well, they were floating in the water in mass. I mean, it wasn't like one dead fish. This is like a whole mess of fish. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, the funny part was Chris Stiles had a symposium up in Halifax, which I went to. I wanted to go to Shag Harbor, and I had a bus trip down there. So we did the whole motion picture thing and all that stuff, and we're all standing around listening to Chris do the thing. So they were just about packing up the cameras, and Chris says, "Oh, by the way, about a week later, a dead fish came up on the shore." And I said, "Thanks, Chris. When are you going to tell me?" But, I mean, that's the half the problem is a lot of these details are insignificant to most people, but they add up.
Yeah.
They add up, and they contribute to the mystery of what the UFO is doing. Now, there is one particular case in this whole mess of dead fish where they did take the fish to a laboratory. And the way it's explained is that the fish had their swim gland destroyed. Well, I know an ichthyologist who used to work at the Philadelphia Museum, and he's down in Florida, and I asked him, I said, "What is this swim gland?" And he says, "Oh, it's kind of like a miniature lung that contains oxygen so that it buoys the fish up in a certain vertical position."
Mm-hmm.
So evidently that was the thing that collapsed and killed the fish or something. So, but none of these other cases had, the fish cases, had anything taken to a laboratory or examined. So that was my main gripe, is that you have this evidence and yet nobody investigates or delves into it.
Now, do you think that there's kind of a radiation connection at all to the mysterious fish death, or do you just think...
Well, it's kind of hard to say. Like I said, we don't have we don't have laboratory results, but there is a lot of radiation cases. And as a matter of fact, I have another paper that I'm just about finished with. I'm waiting for a physicist to help me with a couple of problems. But radiation is a major problem in UFOs in relation to boiling water. You hear about hissing. You hear about boiling. The water is agitated, very agitated, because of the heat. And so it could be radiation killing the fish. It could also be, if it's an electrical field, we always hear UFOs being called electromagnetic. Well, if it's an electric field, it could be electrocution, too.
Right, right. A lot of these radiation... I mean, that just sounds fascinating, where you have a lot of these radiation cases. I mean, that's kind of a scientific tall-tale sign that there's something real going on and potentially dangerous to the ecosystem, if anything else.
Yeah.
And that's interesting that science or universities or scientists are not taking an interest to that.
Well, It works two ways. Academia doesn't want to acknowledge UFOs because we're all, of course, all lunatics, you know.
Right.
But there are a lot of scientists that do come to UFO meetings. You know, it's kind of like coming out of the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And they're willing to sit down and talk about UFOs in a meeting, but not, putting their academic status online, you know, on the line. So I'm sure if the American Academy of Sciences ever gave an okay, you know, for that it was a valid subject, you'd have a lot of people coming out and investigating it. We had major scientists in ufology all along. We had James McDonnell, we had Alan Hynek, Jacques Vallée, and there's a host of scientists that have been on official, unofficial lists, you know, where they can talk freely.
Do you think that time will ever come where science or scientists, in addition to those that are already involved in the field, will really kind of bring down that barrier that kind of separates the two fields? Because, I mean, even though Dr. J. Allen Hynek and Dr. James McDonald did extraordinary work, didn't some parts of science then consider them, oh, well, now they're on the fringe, you know, they're a little loony themselves? And I could completely be wrong about that, but do you think there's ever going to be a time where that boundary comes down?
Well, that's kind of hard to say. I mean, as far as, knocking them as kind of off-fringe scientists, that's academia speaking, you know, because they don't want to get involved and, you know, soiled by UFOs.
Right.
But the scientists themselves get involved. Well, McDonald, his whole marriage folded because he was putting in not only 8 hours of scientific investigation on weather phenomena, he was also 8 hours a day doing UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the man's, that's 16 hours, you don't have a heck of a lot of time for family life.
Yeah, exactly.
So needless to say, he, being an investigative scientist, got hooked. And I'm sure there's a lot of other scientists who are really on the fringe. I mean, my Bible is Paul Hill's Unconventional Flying Objects. Have you heard of it?
I have not, no.
No? Paul Hill was a rocket scientist. He worked on the Apollo program.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the book. He wrote this Unconventional Flying Object book, which helped me, as a matter of fact, in my water thing. I did nothing specific about water, but it had something to do with moving molecules. And the beauty of his thing was he told his daughter not to publish the book until he was dead. He was so fearful that the government might do something to his pension that he didn't want the book published until after he was dead. So that shows you the fear of a government, you know, as well.
Which
is your specialty.
I've heard many stories of the fear from the government on, oh, well, if I do, you know, come clean on what I know. And you know, it is an amazing topic, but hopefully one day, you know, science will recognize the amazing work that you have done in cataloging these cases. And I think the bottom line for me, what sticks out the most, UFO or not, is that this is a problem with the ecosystem, plain and simple. I mean, if you've got these piles and reams of radiation cases, that's something serious. So hopefully we'll get some scientists to come on board and really kind of back the research and figure out what this really is.
Yeah,
Carl?
Well, actually, yeah. Hill has a chapter in there about radiation, and he says there was one particular case where they had the instrumentation to measure it, and the UFO was going up and down in back of a mountain ridge, and as soon as it came up into visual range, the instruments registered the radiation. And then when it went down, the radiation dropped. So he says there was no question that it was radiation generated by the UFO.
Wow.
So,
Do you have a favorite case that you've really kind of that you put out there that say, hey, look at this, this phenomenon is real?
Well, yeah, on that list there, it's not up, but Shag Harbor, the water Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
That case is so fantastic, and I don't think a lot of people realize this happened in 1967, October 4th, I believe it was, 1967, and I don't have it up because I don't. Don Ledger and Chris Stiles wrote a book on Shag Harbor. Chris Stiles was a witness to it at the tender age of 10. And I asked Chris once. He was here in New Jersey, and he. I went to his meeting, and I said, "What do you got, Chris? You got 10, 20 documents?" He says, "Carl, I have a four-drawer file cabinet filled with U.S. and Canadian documents on this thing that doesn't exist."
Wow.
So what he did Freedom of Information Act, he did newspapers, everything. And Don and went and interviewed a couple of the Navy divers. This thing occurred in 60 feet of water, 60 feet at the six-story building. And the Navy sat over this thing for a week, a full week. And finally, the Navy had to move and chase a red submarine out. And when it did, both, it was two UFOs, as a matter of fact. I don't want to get into the whole story. It's pretty long. But it's a fantastic thing. And the book is called Dark Object, if anybody's interested. And it's written by Don and Chris, and it's a tremendous story with a lot of witnesses and a lot of things that happened, and it was a tremendous case. It's better than Roswell. It's actually better than Roswell.
Wow. Well, I definitely want to look that up, and when we come back from this last break, I do want to get kind of a summary of the Shag Harbor case, if you can give that for me and the listeners, because it's one that obviously you hear about a lot in the field, but I don't really have the details on it, and I know you really respect the case and find value in it, so when we return, right here on the Black Vault Radio with Carl Feint, I want to get those details of the Shag Harbor case. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Black Vault Radio. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr. The hour just flew by with Carl Feint on the topic of underwater UFOs. Now, Carl, before I lose you to the constraints of time and the schedule that I am forced to stick to, please tell me and summarize a little bit so my listeners understand what exactly was that Shag Harbor case?
Okay, starting from the top, a pilot that was going from Halifax to Boston reported an explosion in the sky. Meanwhile, on the ground, two sets of teenagers driving in the same towards each other in from different directions saw lights in the sky. These lights stopped over the water. It didn't sink in, and they just sat there. So anyway, the kids called the Royal Mounted Canadian Mounted Police, who have to investigate once you call a complaint in. So anyway, the Canadian police showed up, and sure enough, they saw this thing, and it started going out towards the ocean and then submerging. Well, they're all thinking airplane. They all thought it was an airplane that it was sinking. They had no idea it was a UFO. So the Navy was called in. They did underwater research, and they couldn't find a thing at the site. So anyway, it turns out weeks or months later, all of a sudden, some article came out about, it must have been the same thing that happened at Shelbourne, which is up the coast. It's about a 30-minute bus trip from Shag Harbor. And it turned out this is where the Navy was sitting on top of this UFO. And what was even more interesting is Shelbourne at that time had a place called a government base,
mm-hmm.
A U.S. base on Canadian soil. And it turned out to be Canadian and U.S., but it was tracking submarines. So that's the reason why the Navy knew the UFO had come up the coast. They were tracking it with their equipment. So,
but it obviously was not a submarine.
Exactly.
I see.
And they sent divers down.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the guys were all hanging. Chris says all the guys were hanging over the side of the ship looking down at the UFO through the water. It's only 60 feet of water, so it's right below them.
How big was this craft?
That I didn't remember the size. I think it was like 30 feet or something. I'm not
I see.
Sure.
Okay.
But in any event, after they chased the sub, the Russian sub, there was nothing above them, so they just shot, out into the Gulf of Maine, and then they were seen leaving the Gulf of Maine. I don't have that particular case. I'd love to find out where it's stashed, but they were seen leaving the Gulf of Maine, two of them. One evidently came in to help repair the first ship. So, underwater repairs. How do you like that, John?
Yeah, really. Wow. Well, that sounds fascinating, Carl, and thanks for giving me that summary right here on the bottom of the show. We are almost all out of time, but Carl, I've got to ask you, when is that book coming out?
I just started doing it. Actually, three parts of it are pretty well done. The abductees, heat, and the physical influences. I'm trying to get all these other chapters, these topics of interest in there as well. I figured if I write the book, that'll hang around. If we rely on a website, you know how long they last. Somebody dies and that's the end of the website.
Right. Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I know those who've been listening are looking forward to it. Carl, thank you so much for joining me here on the Black Vault Radio. Again, www.waterufo.net. Carl, thank you so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll have to have you on again. 1,090-plus sightings, and I'm sure that database will grow. You've got a lot to talk about, so we'll bring you back hopefully soon.
My pleasure, sir.
Great. Thank you, and thank you all for listening. We'll see you next time right here on BVRN, the Black Vault Radio. We'll see you then.